myself as this tiny little dot, all the way on the other side of the globe, floating around in space where I was utterly anonymous, a ghost, a stranger, where I could disappear without a trace and nobody I loved would have any idea what happened to me. Poof! It got so bad that I started fantasizing about seriously injuring myself, or that my best friend would die so I wouldn't have to go. For some reason, just canceling my ticket never entered my mind. As luck would have it, however, nobody died, and I found myself being driven to the airport like I was going to my own funeral. The moment I stepped into the international terminal at the airport, however, I was swept up into a sea of colors and people from all over the world and movement and languages, and my terror was instantly bulldozed by excitement. I'm going to freaking India! When I got on the plane, I sat next to this gorgeous Indian woman wearing a pink sari and huge gold earrings who turned to me, smiled, and offered me an M&M. And that's when it really sank in. You're not alone, you ding-dong. You're surrounded by people. And one of the most basic, common human needs is connection. I then proceeded to spend 2 months traveling around a country that is now by far one of my favorite places on this planet, and that sparked in me a love for travel that has completely changed my life. This and other examples from my own life keep proving to me over and over that our greatest fears are the greatest wastes of time. Face your fears with the truth that they're all in your mind and they will lose their power over you. 2. Flip the fear. When you find yourself letting fear push you around, look at it from a different perspective. Start by breaking it down, finding what it is that you're really afraid of, and then flipping it around to make it work for you, not against you. Show it who's boss. Feed your fear a suck-it sandwich. For example, I want to write a book, but I can't get myself to sit down and do it. Why not? I'm scared that if I do it, it'll be terrible. What happens if it's terrible? If it's terrible, I'll look stupid. Then what? People will make fun of me. Then what? I'll feel ashamed. Okay, so you're not writing your book in order to protect yourself from feeling stupid and ashamed. Now flip it. How stupid and ashamed will you feel if you don't write your book? Very. I know it's a brilliant idea, and it's a big dream of mine. So will your strategy of not writing it in order to protect yourself from feeling stupid and ashamed protect you from feeling stupid and ashamed? No. And since you're risking feeling stupid and ashamed either way, which version is worse? Trying to write it and having it be terrible? Or never going for it and living an unlived life of mediocrity, wimpiness, and shame? Living an unlived life of mediocrity, wimpiness, and shame. Break it down so you can really look at and diffuse what it is about a situation that's scaring you. Fear is all about how you choose to look at things. So by changing your perspective on it, you can let the fear of not doing the thing you're scared of fuel your quest to greatness. 3. Be in the moment. Is anything scary happening to you right now, at this very moment? Right now, where you're sitting, is anything bad actually happening, or is it just the thoughts in your head that are freaking you out? You deplete the much-needed energy you need to kick ass by freaking out before something even happens. Instead, stay in the moment and connect to your higher self. If you're about to walk into a courtroom or jump out of a plane or ask for a raise, breathe into the moment and stay connected to source energy. Keep your frequency high and your belief in miracles strong instead of falling prey to the fears in your mind, and you'll find that not only are you much better equipped to deal with whatever situation it is that you're headed for, but that 9 times out of 10, it's much scarier in your mind than it is in reality. 4. Cut off the stream of crap. Be more conscious of the information you absorb. What blogs do you read? What shows do you watch? What books do you read? What stories do you read in the paper? What movies do you go to? Whose opinion do you ask? What do you focus on in your day-to-day life? This isn't about being in denial or out of touch with what's going on in the world. It's about how much of this information you really need. Are you staring at a car accident, or are you gathering information that will allow you to contribute to positive change? Wallowing in the pain and suffering isn't going to help anyone, yourself included, any more than starving yourself will help the hungry. If you want to help the world and yourself, keep your frequency high and do your work from a place of power and joy. 5. Don't think of anything upsetting in bed at night. Our minds turn into gigantic magnifying glasses that make all our fears 100% bigger when we're lying there as a captive audience at 3 a.m. in bed with nothing to distract us. Unless you're going to get out of bed right then and there and take some sort of action, don't waste your precious time thinking about your problems. Every time you do this, it's never as bad the next morning when you get up. You know this, and yet, use your meditative powers to move troubling thoughts out of your mind. Focus on relaxing every single muscle in your body, one by one, slowly and intentionally, so that it takes up all the room in your brain that you were using to freak out with. Breathe deeply and think about all the incredible things in your life. Listen to a guided meditation. Do whatever you can to get a good night's sleep, and then deal with whatever it is in the morning. Because the only thing worse than staying up all night freaking out about something is then being too exhausted the next day to deal with it either. 6. Love yourself, and you will be invincible. Chapter 21, Millions of Mirrors. No one can make you feel inferior without your consent. Eleanor Roosevelt, activist, feminist, superhero, longest-serving First Lady of the United States ever. One of the most staggering things about other people is that they provide us with valuable and often alarmingly intimate information about who they are as soon as we meet them. If we pay attention, we can pick up on the major clues they're sending out through their body language, their appearance, their lifestyle, their actions, their interests, their words, how they treat their dogs, the waitress, themselves, etc. Some people let it all hang out for everyone to see right away. Others let it seep out in little spurts. I love water skiing. I admire how confident you are about your weight problem. I just got out of prison, etc. With the exception of the sociopath or the skilled pathological liar, the majority of humanity gives us plenty to chew on right out of the gate. All of this information then goes through the filter of who we are, and depending on our perceptions and judgments and hang-ups and number of years spent in therapy, we decide if the person is someone we want to get to know better or not. We're all attracted to, as well as turned off by, various things about other people. And the things that stand out the most to us are the things that remind us the most of ourselves. This is because other people are like mirrors for us. If somebody bugs you, you're projecting onto them something you don't like about yourself. And if you think they're awesome, they're reflecting back something that you see in yourself that you like, even if it's not developed in you yet. I know this sounds like I'm making a massive generalization, but just stay with me here. Your reality is created by what you focus on and how you choose to interpret it. This goes for everything, including the things you focus on about the people in your world. For example, depending on who you are, you could react in a myriad of different ways to your new boyfriend or girlfriend constantly referring to you as the giant dumbass. You could A, see this as a red flag and think they're a bully. B, see this as a red flag and think they're nervous or insecure and have terrible manners. C, see this as a green light because they're in so much pain that they need to abuse other people. They really need someone as understanding as I am. D, see this as a green light because you believe that you are, in fact, a giant dumbass. Or E, think it's hilarious because it doesn't resonate with you. The people you surround yourself with are excellent mirrors for who you are and how much or how little you love yourself. We attract people into our lives for a reason, just as they attract us into theirs. We all help each other grow and figure out our issues if we seize the opportunity to learn from instead of just react to, by getting defensive or justifying our actions or whining about, the highly irritating things other people do. It's our annoying friends or family members or clients or neighbors or lady on the train with a voice like a bullhorn who help us grow and see who we truly are, even more than our beloved BFFs do, unless they're being momentarily annoying, and then we can thank them too. Don't miss the glorious opportunity to learn that's being handed to you by the person whose mouth you'd really love to stick your fist in. The things that bother us about other people bother us because they remind us of something we don't like about ourselves. Or their behavior triggers a fear or insecurity that we have, but may not realize we have. For the longest time, one of my big stories was that being feminine was weak and annoying. Somewhere along the way, I decided that it wasn't cool or powerful to act like, or be, a girl, and my feminine self became part of me that I was ashamed of. Hence, I was much less threatened by women who came at me with a power drill than women who came at me with an eyebrow pencil, which is why it's pretty hilarious to me still that one of my best friends is as girly as they get. I met her when we were working together in New York City and was instantly drawn to her because she's hilariously brilliant and sweet and did a flawless impression of one of our co-workers walking down the hall with his ass sticking out that always left me doubled over clinging to furniture. Unlike me, however, she's a lover of girls' nights out and mani-pedi dates, an eager ogler of engagement rings when summoned by the fluttering hand of a soon-to-be bride, and a pro at the girly girl gang greeting. Arms raised high in the air, head back, eyes squeezed shut, high-pitched, "Oh my God!" for all to hear. For this, we call her Pink. A decade later, I'm living in Los Angeles, and Pink is living outside New York City, married with a bunch of kids. Natch. When she decides to take her first solo vacation since becoming a mom and heads to San Diego to see her best friend from college, she calls and begs me to drive down to see her. I agree, somewhat begrudgingly. It wasn't the 2-hour drive that bothered me, but the best friend from college, who I'd never met but was sure was pinker than pink. I imagined a full-on sorority scene, complete with painting our toenails while having a Meg Ryan movie fest and talking about how fat we'd gotten. But I love Pink, so off I went. Meanwhile, down in San Diego, Pink's best friend from college is less than thrilled at the prospect of Pink's best gal pal from her New York City days driving down from L.A. Her eyes were also rolling at the potential estrogen bomb, so imagine our delight when we discovered that we were both equally as macho. Once we realized that the playing field wasn't as overwhelmingly pink as we feared it would be, however, we got the biggest surprise of all. Our inner, neglected girls felt safe to come out of hiding. All three of us lost our voices that weekend, cackling and screaming, "Oh my God!" for all to hear. I wouldn't be surprised if a toenail or two even got painted. Don't remember. Was too drunk on wine spritzers. I'm still not the most enthused member of a bridal shower, and I'm not saying that you have to come around and like everything in this world that bothers you, but I am saying that if you actively don't like something, it's because it resonates with you on some level. It has meaning to you. When you find yourself dealing with someone who irritates you, and you find yourself getting gossipy, finger-pointy, judgy, or complainy, rising up and confronting the situation can do a hell of a lot more than just make your life more pleasant in the long run. It can help you heal and grow and get out of victim mode, because it forces you to deal with the gnarlier aspects of yourself, the parts that make you not so proud. None of us care to admit that we're dishonest, conceited, insecure, unethical, mean, bossy, stupid, lazy, etc. But that's what attracted you to the people you notice it in, and them to you, in the first place. And admitting it is the first step in letting it go. Whee! If people are annoying in a way that has nothing to do with us, we either don't notice it, or we don't get that hung up on it. For example, say there's someone in your life who you find to be an insufferable know-it-all. Every time you open your mouth to talk about something you did, she says she's already done it. Anything you know, she already knows, and knows much more about. And she has to make sure you, and everyone within a 10-mile radius, knows how much more she knows about it. While you find yourself entertaining fantasies about putting her head through the wall every time you're around her, someone else might be hanging on her every word, unable to get enough of her fascinating and brilliant conversation. The reason she makes you so crazy is because you most likely are a know-it-all yourself, or you worry that you are one, or you have insecurities about people thinking you know nothing. Our reality is a mirror of our thoughts, the people in our reality included. Same thing goes with what people throw at us. Would you be offended if someone kept making fun of how short you were if you were 6 feet tall? It most likely wouldn't even register. Or if it did, you'd just think they were kind of strange. But if they teased you about being bossy, and deep down you feared you were, it would definitely get your attention. It would also mean they have energy around their own bossiness if they're recognizing it in you, but that's not your problem. What you focus on, you create more of in your life. If you're consciously or subconsciously focused on certain beliefs about who you are, or who you want to be, or who you do not want to be, you will attract people who mirror those traits right back at you. This is why, when you're dealing with a backstabbing quote-unquote friend, or some sort of toxic person that you need to stand up to or kick out of your life, you get caught up in this self-inflicted trap of not wanting to hurt the other person, or latching onto their finer qualities, or fearing the worst if you don't put up with their crap. I don't care how long you've been friends with someone, or how sorry you feel for them, or how they really helped you those 8 million times, or how hilarious, successful, hot, inspiring, desperate, scary, connected, brilliant, or helpless they are, because the reason you're having trouble standing up to them isn't about any of that. What's really going on is you're being faced with rewiring your limiting beliefs about yourself, and you're using these excuses for these other people to avoid facing your own issues around sticking up for yourself. At the end of the day, it's not about them. It's about you believing you're worthy of being loved and seen for who you really are. When we agree to let ourselves down in favor of supporting the bad behavior of others, it often stems from the same impulse. We're unwilling to make other people more uncomfortable than they just made us. Not terribly studly in the old self-love department, is it? By making them uncomfortable, I mean declining to participate in their drama, by the way, not by being equally abusive back. This isn't about getting an eye for an eye and sinking to a lower level. It's about standing up for your highest self, no matter if the person you're dealing with should choose to have the experience of feeling disappointed, feeling hurt, feeling inconvenienced, seeing you as a crazy person. It's about respecting yourself instead of catering to your insecure need to be liked. This is incredibly powerful because when you love yourself enough to stand in your truth, no matter what the cost, everyone benefits. You start attracting the kinds of things, people, and opportunities that are in alignment with who you truly are, which is way more fun than hanging out with a bunch of irritating energy suckers. And by declining to participate in other people's drama, i.e., refusing to rip people to shreds, to complain about how unfair the world is, etc., you not only raise your own frequency, but you offer the drama queens the chance to rise up too, instead of everyone continuing to play a low, lame game. Never apologize for who you are. It lets the whole world down. We all know someone who does not take shit from anyone. Ever. We look upon these types of people with wide-eyed reverence and would never dream of being stupid enough to present them with any of our own BS or try to make them wrong. Why? Because we respect them and, are usually kind of terrified of them in a healthy way. And why do we respect them? Because they respect themselves. So how can you get rid of your lame-o projections and judgments and grace the world with your highest, most unapologetic self? 1. Own your ugly. Start noticing the things that drive you nuts about other people, and instead of complaining or judging or getting defensive about them, use them as a mirror. Especially if you find yourself getting really worked up. Get mighty real with yourself. Is this quality something you have yourself? Or is there a certain aspect to it that you're loath to admit is just like you? Or does it remind you of something you're actively trying to suppress or avoid? Or that you're actively doing just the opposite of? Or that you're threatened by? Become fascinated by, instead of furious about, the irritants surrounding you. And go get your learning on. 2. Question your ugly. Once you discover what part of yourself you're projecting onto the person who is presently bugging the living crap out of you, you can start letting it go. Begin by asking yourself some very simple questions and diffusing the limiting and false stories you've been lugging around for ages. For example, if you're all pissed off that your friend who's always late is late again, it's pushing your buttons because you're holding onto some sort of quote-unquote truth about the way people should be with time. Flip it around and ask yourself things like, in what ways am I always late or inconsiderate or unreliable? Or maybe it's, in what ways am I too rigid or controlling? Once you have your answer, ask yourself, who do I need to be for this situation not to bother me? Using this scenario, let's say you discover that you're a lot more rigid than you care to admit. This is very valuable information because now you know that in order to be happier, you need to loosen your bone, Wilma. Stop insisting that people do things exactly the way you do them, especially the people in your life who have proven they most definitely won't. Notice where you're being ridiculously demanding simply because it's become your habit and not because it's really necessary. And constantly ask yourself, can I let this one go? By becoming aware of what we do, we can investigate why we do it and then choose to keep it or drop it instead of blindly reacting through habit. What am I getting out of being this way? As discussed in Chapter 17, it's so easy once you figure out it isn't hard. We don't do anything unless we're getting something out of it, even if what we're getting are false benefits. Using this scenario, some of the positive benefits of being rigid are that you're always on time, you get shit done, etc. But there are also some negative advantages to being rigid too. You intimidate people into getting your way. You get to be right whenever someone messes up, which they'll do often if you've really honed the rigid thing well. You get to be in control, etc. Once you bust yourself on the false reward you're getting from holding on to this behavior, you can see it for what it is, something that's not always in alignment with who you truly are and aspire to be, and release it when it's not working. How would I feel if I wasn't this way? One of the best ways to release the aforementioned lousy behavior is by asking yourself how you'd feel if this wasn't true for you anymore. How would I feel if I took the pull out of my ass about everyone doing everything exactly how I say to do it, all the time, in every circumstance? Ask the question and then imagine yourself as this person who has let it go. How does your body feel? What do you use the brain space for that used to be taken up with poisonous thoughts about the inconsiderate pinheads you're surrounded by who are not following your instructions? Feel into the reality of what it would be like to let this go. Breathe into it. Visualize it. Fall in love with not having it anymore. And then kick it to the curb. 3. Don't be an enabler. In the fuzzier cases where you're not sure what to do, but you really do want to help someone, recognize the difference between helping and enabling. When you reach out a helping hand, do you feel like they're pulling you down or that you're lifting them up towards their potential? Are they grateful or entitled? Do they use your help to actively move themselves in a positive direction, or do they constantly need more, more, more? Just this one last time. For the 50th time. Pay attention and trust how you feel. If you're truly helping them and they're rising to the occasion, it will raise everyone's frequencies and you'll feel good. If you're enabling them, you'll feel heavy, depressed, and eventually resentful. While it's no fun to kick someone to the curb when they're at their lowest low, if you constantly bail them out, they'll never wake up and save themselves. Why should they? They've got you to fund their pity party. Tough love is still love. 4. Give painful people the heave-ho. Sometimes, no matter how much work you do on yourself and how forgiving you are and how skilled you get at letting it go, there's just no way around it. Some people are just too committed to their own dysfunction. They're painful to be around. You'd rather cover yourself in the fleas of 1,000 camels than go out for a cup of coffee with them. This is all about learning and loving and growing into the highest version of yourself, not seeing just how much torture you can endure. So along with understanding how to grow from the not-so-savory behavior of those around you, It's also important to understand how to get the hell away from them if they're chronically self-obsessed or violent or blaming or negative or controlling or jealous or high drama or manipulative or victimized or whiny or pessimistic or mean to animals. Here's how. First, feed your head. As discussed, a lot of times the people we need to kick to the curb happen to be those we love, or at least like a lot, for their decent qualities. Hence, ye olde guilt can really get in our way when trying to do the right thing. So stay strong. See it as being nice to yourself instead of being mean to them. Remembering that you are rising up to the highest version of yourself instead of shrinking down to their level can give you the strength you need to shake them off your leg. Next, hit eject. Another important thing to remember when yanking the weeds out of your garden is not to get involved in their drama. Cut the cord as quickly and simply as possible with little to no discussion. If they're so oblivious to your feelings that you need to toss them out of your life, chances are very good they won't see this coming. So the discussion on why you need to end it could go on for the rest of your lives if you let it. Suddenly get really busy. Fade them out. Wean them off you with zero explanation. The louder they scream, the busier you suddenly get. If having a conversation is unavoidable, remember, you've already decided that you want out, so don't get sucked into working through your decision or their problems with them. Simply say that the relationship isn't working for you, that you don't like how it makes you feel, that you have to end it, and that it's not open for discussion. Make it all about you. Give them nothing to work with or argue about. 5. Love yourself. Fiercely, loyally, unapologetically. Chapter 22. The Sweet Life. It's great to be here. It's great to be anywhere. Keith Richards, rock god, connoisseur of life. I've got a cat who's 22 years old. I've also got a dad who's 87. The cat and my dad share the same superhero power. They both have the ability to make me pay lots of attention to them and be nicer to them than I am to anyone else. Anyone else not staring down the barrel of their impending mortality, that is. I first realized that my cat was old and might die soon about a year ago when, overnight, all his body fat plunged to his belly region, causing him to swing it around like an udder and leaving him with a spine that's still in shock, jutting out all spindly and jagged, wondering where everybody went. This is when the teary farewells started every time I'd leave the house, and the fancy wet food began appearing in his bowl. In Dad's case, the phone calls and flights back east have escalated dramatically, and I now laugh hysterically at all his jokes, no doubt making him worry more about my well-being than I do about his. I'm thrilled to report that even though in the calendar's opinion they're real old, they're both still kicking butt. Dad plays tennis once a week and still knows who I am, and my cat still runs when he hears the can opener. They're also excellent reminders. When it comes to the creatures you love and the things you love and the life you love, what on earth could possibly be more important than soaking them up right now while you've still got the opportunity? If it's something you want to do, don't wait until you're less busy or richer or quote-unquote ready or 20 pounds lighter. Start right now. You'll never be this young again. If it's the people you love, visit them as often as possible. Act as if every time you see them will be the last. If they bug you sometimes, love them anyway. If you've got differences, get over them. Don't get so tangled up in the stupid little stuff that you miss out on enjoying the people who have part ownership of your heart. If you're not where you want to be in life, keep going. Treat yourself like you're the closest friend you've got. Celebrate the magnificent creature that you are. Don't let anyone mess with you in your dreams, least of all, yourself. Your life is happening right now. Do not snooze and lose. Love yourself while you've still got the chance. Part 5. How to Kick Some Ass. Chapter 23. The Almighty Decision. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. The moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. W. H. Murray, Explorer, Mountain Climber, Committer. The story goes that when Henry Ford first came up with the idea for his V8 motor, he wanted the engine to have all eight cylinders cast in one block. I have no idea what that means, but apparently it was a tall order because his team of engineers was like, "Bitch! You crazy!" He told them to do it anyway, and off they grumbled to toil away at it, only to come back and inform him that it was impossible. Upon hearing this news, Ford told them to keep at it, no matter how long it took. He was all, "I don't want to see your faces until you bring me what I want." And they were all, "We just proved it can't be done." And he was all, "It can't be done, and it will be done." And they were all, "Cannot." And he was all, "Can so." And they were all, "No way." And he was all, "Way." So off they went again, and this time for a whole year, and nothing. So they go back to Ford, and there's lots of tears and finger-pointing and hair-pulling, and Ford sends them off again and tells them it will be done again. And then, in the lab, somewhere between folding origami swans out of their notes and making fart noises every time someone mentions the word Ford, his engineers do the impossible. They discover how to make his eight-cylinder engine block. This is what it means to make a decision for reals. When you make a no-nonsense decision, you sign up fully and keep moving towards your goal regardless of what's flung in your path. And stuff will most definitely get flung, which is why making the decision is so crucial. This shit is not for sissies. The moment it gets hard or expensive or puts you at risk of looking like a moron, if you haven't made the decision, you will quit. If it wasn't uncomfortable, everyone would be out there all in love with their fabulous lives. So often we pretend we've made a decision when what we've really done is signed up to try until it gets too uncomfortable. Henry Ford didn't even make it past the sixth grade, and there he was, bossing around a bunch of the world's biggest engineering smarty pantses, setting himself up to look like a total idiot by spending large amounts of money and time on the proven impossible. Ford was determined, and he trusted his gut and his vision more than the small thinking of others. He'd made the decision that he would have his engine the way he would have it, and nothing was going to stop him. This is why the decision is so important. If you had an idea and had to go up against a room full of people who quote-unquote knew better than you did and demand they do what you say in spite of all the proof they had against you, would you stick to your guns? Or if you needed tens of thousands of dollars to start your new business, and the only person you could think of to ask was your scary, rich uncle who never remembered who you were even though you saw him every Christmas, would you ask him for it? Or if you were sick of feeling fat and unsexy and out of shape, and the only time you could make it to the gym was at 5 a.m. on freezing winter mornings when you were all snuggly in bed, would you go? If you made the decision that you were going to reach your goals, you would do whatever it took. If you merely wanted to, but hadn't made the firm decision to, you'd roll over and begin convincing yourself that your life is fine just the way it is. This is where being connected to your desire and source energy and having an unshakable belief in the not yet seen is so critical. There are plenty of times when we get a brilliant idea and it temporarily fails, or it pushes us into unfamiliar territory. If we don't have a strong connection to the truth, we live in an abundant universe, we are awesome, glorious, tear-jerkingly lovable, etc., a blazing desire, and an unflinching belief in our own vision before it's manifested, we'll fall prey to our own fears and everyone else's fears that it's not possible and give up, instead of course-correcting or pushing on through and bringing it to life. As Winston Churchill so aptly explained, success consists of going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. Nobody gets to the top of the mountain without falling on his face over and over again. By the way, back when Henry Ford insisted to a room full of annoyed engineers that his V8 engine could be built the way he envisioned it, it was after he'd already gone bankrupt in his first attempt at creating an automobile empire. So at that time, he already had plenty of proof that he was capable of failing on a massive scale. But his faith in himself and his vision was so strong that he stuck with it, in spite of all the evidence around him that pointed to big fat loser, and became one of the most successful entrepreneurs of all time. Temporary failure is all the rage. All the cool kids have done it. Michael Jordan was cut from his high school basketball team for lack of skill. Steven Spielberg, a high school dropout, was rejected from film school 3 times. Thomas Edison, who was dubbed too stupid to learn anything by a teacher, tried more than 9,000 experiments before successfully creating the light bulb. Soichiro Honda, the founder of Honda Motor Company, was turned down by Toyota for an engineering position, so he started his own damn company. Beethoven's music teacher told him he was talentless, and more specifically, was hopeless at composing. Beethoven turned a deaf ear. I know. So bad. Sorry. Fred Smith wrote a paper while at Yale about his big idea for an overnight delivery service. He got a C. He went on to create FedEx anyway. The only failure is quitting. Everything else is just gathering information. There's no big mystery to this stuff. If you want something badly enough and decide that you will get it, you will. You've done it before. You've lost the weight, gotten the job, bought the house, quit the nasty habit, gotten in shape, asked someone out, splurged on the front row tickets, grown out your bangs. You just need to remember that you can do it with anything in your life, even the things that you presently think are out of your reach. There are plenty of people out there in the world living the kind of life you only dream about living, many of whom are far less fabulous and talented than you are. The key to their success is that they decided to go for it. They stopped listening to their tired old excuses, changed their lousy habits, and got the fuck on the fuck. Here's how you can too. 1. Want it bad. You need to have a 10-ton gorilla of desire behind your decision, or else you'll wimp out the second things get hard. It's like people who get hypnotized to quit smoking when they really don't want to quit, or who try to lose weight when they're more excited by pizza than being able to look down and see their feet. It never works. A few months ago, I dragged my ass to yoga class for a solid week, even though I just so did not feel like doing it. I paid my money, sat down on my mat, and was surprised to find my hand raised in the air when the instructor asked if anyone had any injuries she should know about. I then heard myself explaining that I'd just gotten the cast off my broken elbow and should really take it easy. I am an adult. I am very busy. I spent money on that class and then lied so I didn't have to participate. I did have a cast, but it had come off about 8 months earlier. I spent the majority of yoga week quietly napping on my mat and conjuring up my best wincing in pain face in case she was looking at me while I was half-assing down dog. It was ridiculous. If you're going to push through major obstacles to reach your goal, you can't just want to. You need to be in a full-on tizzy of excitement about what it is you're going after and hold on to it like a pit bull. In order to do this, you need to have the audacity to be honest about what you really want to do, not what you should do. Believe it's available to you, regardless of any evidence otherwise, and go for it. 2. Get good at it. To decide literally means to cut off. No wonder so many people are totally freaked out by it. The terror around making the wrong decision can be so overwhelming to some people that they develop the habit of A, waffling back and forth, paralyzed by self-doubt and terror, finally eking out a quote-unquote decision that they then proceed to change over and over and over again, B, making decisions hastily, without thinking or feeling into them, their main goal being to escape the discomfort and get the damn thing over with already, or C, being so afraid that if they pick one thing, they'll miss out on another, so they either choose to do nothing or try to do everything, which are both excellent ways to miss out on all of it. They basically decide to never decide because they don't want to make the wrong decision. Good times! Deciding is freedom. Indecision is torture. Indecision is one of the most popular tricks for staying stuck within the boundaries of what's safe and familiar, which is why a common trait of successful people is that they make decisions quickly and change them slowly. And by quickly, I don't mean that you must know exactly what to do the moment a decision presents itself, although there are those people who do, but rather that you immediately face the damn thing and start working through your decision-making process, whatever that may look like, sleeping on it, making a list of the pros and cons, feeling into it, etc. If you're a waffler, or prefer to avoid the process altogether, a great thing to do is practice on the little things to build up your decision-making muscle. When eating at a restaurant, make yourself pick something off the menu in under 30 seconds. Once you choose, you are authorized to change your mind or your order. Give yourself 20 minutes to go online and research the best garlic press and then make the purchase. Pick things off the shelves at the supermarket in under 10 seconds. Knock yourself out of the habit of being a deer stuck in the headlights by demanding you wake up and choose something. If you're someone who needs to sleep on it or mull it around a bit, give yourself a deadline. Don't leave it open to decide when you'll decide and risk waking up 40 years later, finally sure of what to do, long after the opportunity has passed you by. Pay attention to how much time you need to decide, overnight, a week, a month, and demand of yourself that you figure it out by then. If you're wired for making instant decisions, practice tuning into your intuition and fully trusting what it says, regardless of what your brain may be screaming about. Get quiet, listen for and feel into the answer, and practice acting on your first solid impulse. And whoever you are, please stop saying how pathetic you are at making decisions. Erase the phrase, "I don't know," from your vocabulary and replace it with, "I'll know what to do soon enough." Decide to become the person who makes quick, smart decisions, and you will. 3. Eliminate the negotiation process. When I decided to quit smoking, if I even toyed with thoughts like, "Well, what harm will one itty-bitty drag do?" I was screwed. Our decisions must be watertight, because excuses will seep through any little cracks in our resolve, and before we know it, we'll be on our asses. Decisions are not up for negotiation. The old you, the one who has not yet decided to kick ass, is in the past. Stay present and do not, even for one second, look backwards or entertain any ideas of straying from your decision. Think only of the new you. The whole point of deciding is to stop wasting time and to move forward, not to spend time figuring out how you can wiggle out of your decision. It helped me to think of it this way. I'm not going to go home and negotiate about whether or not I'm going to smoke a cigarette, just as I'm not going to go home and negotiate about whether or not to snort some horse tranquilizers. I don't negotiate about snorting horse tranquilizers because I'm not a horse tranquilizer snorter. Now that I don't smoke, I'm not going to negotiate about smoking because I don't smoke. 4. Stick like glue. I used to write for an entrepreneurial magazine where I got to interview all these hugely successful business owners. Whenever I asked them what the secret to their success was, the overwhelming majority answered, tenacity. Be the last person standing. Wear down your obstacles and excuses and fears and doubts until they're finally like, "You? Again? Jesus H. Christ, fine, here you go. Now get out of my face." Birthing your dreams is like giving birth. Conceiving the idea is the fun part, hopefully. Then you go through insane amounts of fear and excitement and dreaming and planning and vomiting and growing and thinking you're crazy and thinking you're awesome and stretching and shape-shifting until you're practically unrecognizable to everyone, even your own self. Along the way, you clean up your puke and massage your aching back and apologize to all the people whose heads you ripped off in a hormonal killing spree, but you stay the course because you know this baby of yours is going to be the bomb. Then, finally, just when you can see a light at the end of the tunnel, labor starts. Your innards twist and strangle and force you to stumble around hunched over in the shape of the letter C, while you breathe and pray and curse, and just when you think it can't get any more out of your mind painful, a giant baby head squeezes out of a tiny hole in your body. Then, a full-blown miracle appears. In order to change your life and start living a new one that you've never lived before, your faith in miracles and yourself must be greater than your fear. However easy or rough your birth process is, you have to be willing to fall down, get up, look stupid, cry, laugh, make a mess, clean it up, and not stop until you get there, no matter what. 5. Love yourself. You can do anything. Chapter 24, Money, Your New Best Friend. I worked for a menial's hire, only to learn, dismayed, that any wage I asked of life, life would have willingly paid. Anonymous. Many years ago, Los Angeles was hit by a relentless rainstorm, the likes of which I'd never seen in my life. It rained for what seemed like 40 days and 40 nights, nonstop and hard. Rivers overflowed, houses slid down hillsides, bad hair wreaked chaos throughout the most image-conscious city in the world. This was the kind of rain you didn't want to be driving around in anything, let alone a 23-year-old junker convertible with a leaky roof, no grill, a back window that was duct taped shut, and a front tire that went flat every 3 days. I'd been in the market for a new car for a long time and couldn't find anything I really loved or thought I could afford. But as I sat there in a puddle, driving to the supermarket with a trash bag under my ass and an old t-shirt slammed in the door to keep the leaking to a minimum, it occurred to me that perhaps I should speed up my search. At the time, I didn't have a whole lot of money, but I had my own business that I was trying to grow. The problem was, I felt stuck in that place where even though I wanted bigger and better things for myself monetarily, as well as feeling more mighty and self-actualized in general, I was worried that if I raised my prices, I'd lose all my clients and my self-respect, or that I'd get called out as a money-grubbing pig or a fraud who had no right to charge that much. I was also scared that if I went big and grew my business, I wouldn't be able to handle it. I'd have to hire tons of people, spend my time doing things I hated, and get so busy I'd never get to travel again. Basically, that I'd wither and die trapped behind my computer, fun and freedom skidding away in my rearview mirror, never to be seen again. Blah, blah, blah. I could talk for about 4 more hours explaining why I was where I was, but suffice it to say, I was basically playing at the level of someone who drives around in a car like the one I was driving around in. And the most painful part really was that even though all signs pointed to broke, clueless, and stuck, deep down I knew I could be doing so much better. Which is why, even though the sound of crickets could be heard echoing throughout my empty bank account, I wandered into the Audi dealership, took the brand new Q5 for a spin, and let the sales guy rattle on and on about leather this and premium that. In my head, I was thinking, do you have any idea who I am? I'm just taking a fantasy break before heading over to Honda. But in my heart, I knew better. Way down deep, it was about much more than just a damn car. It was about no longer being the kind of person who takes what she can get and finally becoming the kind of person who creates exactly what she wants. It was large, Marge. And because part of me was terrified to grow and part of me wanted to blast out and be huge, and also because I love to drive more than I love to eat, I tortured myself over which car to buy for weeks. I finally whittled it down to 2 options. The Honda CR-V, a perfectly excellent little SUV with all the following attributes. Okay gas mileage, a sunroof, room for friends, a comfy ride, a ho-hum stereo, reasonably fun to drive, decently priced. Or the Audi Q5, a stick of butter on 4 wheels with the following attributes. Okay gas mileage, a sunroof that takes up the entire roof of the car, room for friends, big, fat, and tall ones, leather seats you could have a sexual relationship with, a stereo designed by God himself, angels sing when you open the doors, sexy, flashy, expensive, pretentious, terrifying. I came very close to buying the Honda, but as I sat there, test driving it for the 10th time, trying to convince myself that this was the one, I couldn't shake the nagging truth that I was in love with someone else. Buying the Honda would have been the sensible thing to do, but I knew that adventure, true love, and a whole new way of life awaited me on the other side of my comfort zone. Blasting through this comfort zone is what I want to talk about here. Purchasing the Audi should have had me waking up screaming in the middle of the night, because it costs the kind of money I would normally only consider spending on something like mandatory heart surgery, certainly not on something as frivolous as a car. But after I bought it, I slept like a baby. Because once I made the decision to buy it, I also made the decision to get over my shit and become the kind of person who can make the kind of money to buy that kind of car, or who can do anything else I want to do. I almost instantly came up with a way to pay off the Audi, and am certain that if I'd bought the Honda, I'd still be struggling to pay for it. Because I'd still be playing small, I'd still be in the mindset that I can't afford more, that I'm the kind of person who has to struggle to get whatever she can, that I can't break out of my mold and go get something completely, quote-unquote, out of my reach, etc. When you up-level your idea of what's possible and decide to really go for it, you open yourself up to the means to accomplish it as well. I'm not talking about going out and recklessly blowing all your money on stupid crap. I'm talking about expanding your beliefs about what is available to you in all areas of your life. And for the purposes of this chapter, I'm going to focus on what kind of money you believe is here for you to purchase the things and experiences you truly desire. Whether or not the money is currently in your bank account is irrelevant. I didn't have the money either when I bought my new car. When you're available to play a bigger game, i.e. quit your ho-hum job and invest in your own business, buy a new house, send your kids to private school, hire a coach, hire a house cleaner, buy a new mattress, etc., you either need to pay for it with the money you have or manifest the money if you don't have it already. And manifesting it is going to be pretty damn hard if you insist that not only is it not there for you, but that you aren't the kind of person who could ever make it or pay it off if you borrowed it. In order to transform your life, you may have to spend the money you do have, get a loan, sell something, borrow from a friend, put it on your credit card, or manifest it in some other way. Which is going to go against some pretty deep-seated beliefs we've all been raised with about how going into debt is irresponsible. Unless it's a student loan, of course, because for some reason we've decided in that case, and that case only, it's okay. This is about taking a leap of faith into a new realm that you strongly desire to be in. Demanding of yourself that you rise to the occasion and start living your damn life already. After I took my great leap into luxury car land, I made multiple six figures with my business for the first time ever, began traveling the world on a regular basis, got my third book deal, made huge donations, for me anyway, to causes I'm really passionate about, and helped my clients achieve similar personal bests too. Here's the thing. Making money isn't only about the money, just as losing weight isn't only about losing weight, and finding your soulmate isn't only about finding your soulmate. It's about who you become and what you believe is possible for yourself. Money is currency, and currency is energy. As we've discussed, we live in a universe that is vibrating with energy. Our universe is abundant, and everything you desire is here, in this moment, waiting for you to shift your perception and your energy and receive it, money included. Money is energy like anything else, and when you're operating at a high frequency with no resistance to it and take right action, you can manifest the money you desire. We all know that we have to work to make money. We've been taught that all our lives, but what we're not taught is that we must also align our energy with the financial abundance we seek. In other words, act as if you're where you want to be. Don't hang out with sad sacks and people who whine about how broke they are all the time. Erase the words, I can't, from your vocabulary. Envision what you desire, set goals, and demand of yourself that you become who you need to become to create the life you desire. Our relationship to money is just as important as the action we take to manifest it, which is one reason why so many people who work their asses off their whole lives, but who have lousy energy around money, are left wondering why they have nothing to show for it. Here's a little one-sided dialogue that may or may not sound familiar to you. Yay! I think you're fun to hang out with, too! Wait, what? You think I'm the root of all evil? How can you say that? All you talk about is how you wish you had more of me, even though you're scared to admit you like me. And you say I'm not there for you. And you think people who like me are greedy pigs. Yet you get so ecstatic whenever I show up. And you work so hard to get me to come over. But I keep you in a constant state of worry. And you hate dealing with me. And no matter what I do, it's never enough. One minute you act like you'll die without me, and the next I make you feel like a filthy whore. You know what? I'm done. See you later, freak. Considering that this, or some version of this, is the sort of relationship most people have with money, I don't think the question is, why can't we make the kind of money we want? I think the better question is, how the hell do we expect to? Most people have such conflicted feelings around money that they turn it into a full-on circus, rivaled only by the equally popular freak shows surrounding religion and sex. All three are crammed to the brim with issues and anxieties and staunch fight-to-the-death beliefs that cause them to bring so much sadness to the world. Meanwhile, if everyone would just chill out, sex, money, and religion could be the leading causes of joy. Silly, ain't we? In order to bring money joyfully into our lives, we have to understand that we're having a relationship with it, and then treat it like any other important and meaningful relationship. We need to pay attention to it, want it, nurture it, put effort into it, respect it, cherish it, love it, etc. Ridding yourself of your fear and loathing of money, be it conscious or subconscious, is essential if you want to make any. I was extremely poverty proud for so long. I felt I was so much nobler in my pursuit of art and fun and altruism than those people who wasted their lives just going after money. No way in hell was I going to sacrifice my awesome life just to chase the filthy dollar. No, instead I was going to choose between having health insurance or a place to live. I was going to spend precious time that I could have spent making money, driving an extra 30 blocks to the gas station where I could save 3 cents a gallon, sifting through piles of clothes in search of the gems at Goodwill, clipping coupons, hunting down sales, researching which bars had free food at happy hour. Productive things like that. In my quest to make money an inconsequential part of my life, I was basically thinking about it more than anyone who actually had money ever thought about it. What I didn't realize was that it's not an either-or situation. I could make great money and keep my integrity and have more fun and make more art and help more people and make a bigger difference in the world. Oh. I just had to get over myself. I had to stop working with the equation that wanting slash having money equals greedy scumbag. And I had to get a freaking plan. First rule of wealth consciousness. Come from a place of abundance, not lack. When we say we want money for something, we often come from a place of, I don't have it, it does not exist, so I need to create it. This has us focusing on and believing in lack, thereby lowering our frequency and attracting more lack. When we say, I am manifesting